Madhava Kunja Bihari. Gopijana Vallabha Kivaradhari. Gopijana Vallabha Kivaradhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tiravana Chari. Yamuna Tiravana Chari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Jaya Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Pad Eva Jakacharya Satipta Sera Sri Shrimad Bhakti Vedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jaya Om Vishnu Pad Paramahamsa Pad Eva Jakacharya Satipta Sera Sri Shrimad Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Goswami Prabhupada Ki Jai. Ananta Koti Vaishnavindi Ki Jai. Namacharya Slaharidas Thakur Ki Jai. Premsa Kohamsa Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasari Gaur Bhakti Vindiki Jai. Sisi Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Shyama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai. Sri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Mayapur Navadip Dham Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai. Sri Nu Ramanreti Ki Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakti Vindiki Jai. Go Premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sisi Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskrityam. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devam Sarasvatam Vyasam. Today we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 9, the passing away of Bhishma Dev. Text 14. Sarvam kala karitam manye. Bhavatam cha yat apriyam. Sapalo yadvase loko. Vayuri vaganan vali. Sarvam kala kritam manye. Bhavatam chayat apriyam. Sapalo yadvase loko. Vayuri vaganan vali. Sarvam kala kritam manye. Bhavatam chayat apriyam. Sapalo yad vase roko. Vayori vaganam vari. Sarvam kala kritam manye. Bhavatam chayat apriyam. Sapala jat jas vase loka. Sapado Yadvasero Ko Vayu Iva Gananvali Sarvam Kala Kitam Manye Bhavatam Chayadapriyam Sapado Yadvasero Ko Ladies, Sarvam Kala Kitam Manye Bhavatam Chayada Priyam Sapalo Yadvase Loko Vayori Vaganan Vali Sarvam kala kitam manye Bhavacham chayada priyam Sapalo yadvase loko Vayori vaganan vali Sarvam all this kala kritam done by inevitable time Manye, I think. Bhavatam cha, for you also. Yat, whatever. Apriyam, detestable. Sapara, with the rulers. Yat vase, under the control of that time. Loka. Everyone in every planet. Vayo, the wind carries. Eva, as. Gana Anvali, a line of clouds. Translation. In my opinion, this is all due to inevitable time, under whose control everyone in every planet is carried. Just as the clouds are carried by the wind. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. There is control by time over all the space within the universe, as there is control by time all over the planets. As the big gigantic planets, including the sun, are being controlled by the force of air, as the clouds are carried by the force of air. Similarly, the inevitable kala, or time, controls even the action of the air and other elements. Everything, therefore, is controlled by the supreme kala, a forceful representative of the Lord within this material world. Thus, Yudhisthira should not be sorry for the inconceivable action of time. Everyone has to bear the actions and reactions of time as long as one is within the conditions of material world. Yudhisthira should not think that he had committed sins in his previous birth and is suffering the consequences. Even the most pious has to suffer the condition of material nature. But a pious man is faithful to the Lord, for he is guided by the bona fide Brahmins and Vaishnavas following the religious principles. These three guiding principles should be the aim of life. One should not be disturbed by the tricks of eternal time. Even the great controller of the universe, Brahmaji, is also under the control of that time. Therefore, one should not grudge being thus controlled by time, despite being a true follower of religious principles. Om Gyanatimirandasya Ginandana Sarakaya Chakshurun Militam Gena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. This is not a happy time in the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not a blissful event. If we can take our minds to that field of Kurukshetra, it's just after the war. 640 million bodies are strewn all over the place with their chariots and their horses. The smell must have been pretty intense as people were picking through the different areas. They had performed the ceremonies and rites, the last rites of everyone, and practically speaking, almost everyone was dead, all the Kshatriya warriors. Their wives and children, if there were lamenting. Bhishma Dev was a grandfather. He was not an ordinary person. Even amongst that gathering, all the sages and different people had come from all over the universe to witness his death. So there were great personalities from all over the universe sitting there, waiting to hear him speak. When he was born of Santanu and Ganga, everybody remembers we've been talking the last several days about all these different events. So he was taken by Ganga because Santanu was questioning why you're killing all our children. And one of their agreements was that if he ever questioned her, then she would leave. And when she left, she took the baby. But she went to the heavenly planets because she's a goddess. And there, during the subsequent 16 years of his upbringing, he was instructed and taught and educated by the heavenly beings in those heavenly planets. His guru for the Vedas was Vishishta, the same sage that was Lord Ram's guru. He learned political science from Brihaspati, the guru of the demigods. And he learned Dhanur Veda, or the weaponry, the use of different astras and weapons, from Parasaram, Bhargava. And then after the 16 years, Ganga brought him back down to earth and left him in the care of Santanu as the head, the apparent heir of the Kuru dynasty, of the Kuru throne. So his whole life was geared toward this path. He was well versed in it. He was worthy of being heard from. But Yudhisthira, at the end of this whole sojourn and epic pastimes, was not at this time, in this particular juncture, after the whole thing had taken place. I mean, we can go all the way back to the time when Bhumi was suffering and went to Lord Brahma and was complaining about the overabundance of military strength on the earthly planet. You can go as far back as that to this, linking all these things together. This is towards the culmination of the end of Krishna's pastimes. And Bhishma's been shot through his body. He's laying on the ground. People from all over the universe had come. And Yudhisthira was so mortified, he thought all this was done for him to be on the throne. And it was too much for him to bear. He wasn't willing. He wasn't going to do it. It's not that he was enthusiastic, oh, now I've won the war and I'll take over the kingdom. He was not of that mentality at all. At the end of the last chapter, there's a nice purport which describes how this all came about. It's text 14, 1914. Oh no, I'm sorry, that's what we're doing today. It's 1846. King Yudhisthira, who was much aggrieved, could not be convinced, despite instructions by great sages headed by Vyas and by Lord Krishna himself, the performer of superhuman feats, despite all historical evidence. So everybody's trying to enthuse him and encourage him to take up his duty of being the monarch of the world, but he was unwilling to do so. Purport. The pious King Yudhisthira was mortified because of the mass massacre of human beings in the Battle of Kurukshetra, especially on his account. Duryodhana was there on the throne and was doing well in his administration. And in one sense, there was no need of fighting. But on the principle of justice, Yudhisthira was to replace him. The whole clique of politics centered around this point. And all the kings and residents of the whole world became involved in this fight between the rival brothers. Lord Krishna was also there on the side of King Yudhisthira. It is said in the Mahabharata, Adiparva 20, that 640 million men were killed in 18 days on the Battle of Kurukshetra, and some hundreds and thousands were missing. Practically, this was the greatest battle in the world within 5,000 years. This mass killing, simply to enthrone Maharaj Yudhisthira, was too mortifying. So he tried to be convinced with evidences from histories and great sages like Vyas and Lord himself that the fight was just because the cause was just. But Maharaj Yudhisthira would not be satisfied, even though he was instructed by the greatest personalities of the time. Krishna is designated herein in this verse as the performer of superhuman actions. But in this particular instance, neither he nor Vyasadeva could convince King Yudhisthira. Does this mean that he failed to be a superhuman actor? No, certainly not. The interpretation is that the Lord is Isvara, or Supersoul, in the hearts of both King Yudhisthira and Vyas, performed still more superhuman action because the Lord desired it. As Supersoul of King Yudhisthira, he did not allow the king to be convinced by the words of Vyas and others, including himself, because he desired the king to hear the instructions from the dying Bhishmadev, who was another great devotee of the Lord. The Lord wanted, at the last stage of his material existence, the great warrior Bhishmadev see him personally and see his beloved grandchildren, King Yudhisthira, etc., now situated on the throne, and thus pass away very peacefully. Bhishmadev was not at all satisfied to fight against the Pandavas, who were all his beloved fatherless grandchildren. But the Kshatriyas are also very stern people, and therefore he was obliged to take the side of Duryodhana because he was maintained at the expense of Duryodhana. Besides this, the Lord also desired that King Yudhisthira be pacified by the words of Bhishmadev, so that the world could see that Bhishmadev excelled all in knowledge, including the Lord himself. So this sets the scene of what's going on, and we're just at the beginning. This is only the third verse that Bhishmadev spoke. And Srimad Bhagavatam, we should note, is just a summary of the events. The Mahabharata has hundreds of verses that Bhishmadev instructed to Yudhisthira. So we're getting like a condensed, essential version of his presentation. In this particular verse, it's interesting because this setup of Yudhisthira especially, our hearts don't easily change. It's not just because you hear something. Especially the deeper the emotion, the deeper the necessity, the deeper the feelings are embedded in a person, the more difficult it is to change. So in his initial presentation to Yudhisthira, he doesn't all of a sudden just say, well, this is Krishna's plan, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and you just have to surrender to it. That isn't satisfying to one's heart, unless there is a whole foundation of understanding who and what Krishna is and what our relationship is with him. And in this particular instance, right at the beginning of the conversation, he's not starting off that way. He's starting off almost in an impersonal way. In my opinion, this is all just due to time. Now, that's an introduction that will lead to something else. But since this is my verse today, I'm going to focus on this particular aspect of time. And how Srila Prabhupada points out that it controls everyone all over the universe. There is no time as we know it in the spiritual world. Time doesn't exist there like it does here. There's no past, present, and future. There's just eternal existence, eternal time. When Mahavishnu glances over the pradhan and infuses it with spiritual energy and enters it as Garbhodakshai Vishnu, the material elements become agitated and start to manifest as the gross and subtle elements. That begins time. But it doesn't actually get to be calculated until the sun manifests. And according to the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, time is calculated by how many atoms the sun's movement covers. Like, if it covers 3 atoms, that's 1 unit of time. If it covers 10 atoms as it moves, then that's another calculation of time. And of course, we have seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, decades, centuries, and millennia in our calculation of time. And time is relative according to the planet you're on, the place you're on, and the body you're in. Srila Prabhupada often gives the example of the bugs that live only during the night. They're born when it gets dark and they die before the sun comes up, so they never see light. But that in that time, their 100 years takes place. All their children are born, their families are growing, their marriages are taking place. He gives that example, all by the time morning comes in bug life. Whereas in Brahmaloka, we know from the story of Indradumna, when I was doing my research on Lord Jagannath, what happened was that Vishvavasu was a local, Odian, and he was worshipping Lord Nilamadava. For the first half of Lord Brahma's life, Lord Nilamadava was the presiding deity of that Shankh Kshetra, Jagannath Puri. But for the second half of his life, Lord Jagannath is the presiding deity. So just as there's a universal shift going on here in our pastime that we're reading about now, at that time there was also a shift of that deity changing location or changing his manifestation. And simultaneously, in the story from Purusottama Kshetra of the Skanda Purana, Indradumna, the king, wanted to see the Lord, and he sent his different Brahmins out to different parts of the world to find him. And we all know the story, how they came back and explained to him that in Purusottama Kshetra there was this deity. He went there, the log came, he had the log carved, he built a temple, and then he wanted to invite, Narada Muni had come from Lord Brahma to help organize all these events. And then he wanted to invite Lord Brahma to come inaugurate the temple and install the deity. So he asked Narada Muni, let's go to Lord Brahma. And Narada took him to Brahmaloka. But when they arrived at Brahmaloka, Lord Brahma was listening to some music, and therefore the chaukidar that guarded the door said, just wait a little minute, he's listening to some music, he's busy. The music finished, the raga was completed, and then Narada Muni came in and Indradumna, and they met Lord Brahma. While they were speaking with Lord Brahma explained that since you've been here, everything that you knew on earth has already died. It's already over. Hundreds of generations subsequent to you being king are now manifest because time here is different than it is there. So just like when we go to India, it's no longer Eastern Standard Time. It's Indian Standard Time. You change the environment, you enter into what's going on there in that time zone. So apparently, even though they're earthly beings, if people from Earth go to the heavenly planets, well, there's so many instances. A few days ago there was another discussion about it. When you go to that new location, time is relative to that location. Even the whole universe is only 4 cubits to Lord Brahma, just like our body is only 4 cubits to our existence. So everything here is relative. And it's all controlled according to that reality, according to time and space. Every living entity in the material world, from Brahma down to the ant, is controlled, conditioned, and in the experience of that time and space. So Bhishma Dev is using that dynamic, the mechanics of that, to present his initial presentation to Yudhisthira. You have to understand that it's not just you. It's the world around you. It's time. It's something more powerful than you that has brought this about. You did your duty. Now, at this point, there's a really interesting dynamic between, again, two different schools of thought and ways, psychological ways, to deal with suffering and unwanted events. In this particular instance, Bhishma is saying it's not due to your past sinful reactions that you're suffering this. It's due to something much bigger. It's due to time. It's due to the Lord's plan, which will come about later. It's not due to the fact that you performed some previous sinful action. So he's giving Yudhisthira and us, and everyone, a psychological net of how to catch ourselves and deal with trouble, and deal with pain, and deal with unwanted events that happen in life. Understanding that there is daivi potencies, there's godly energies that force us into these situations. Now, when Lord Brahma stole the cows from Lord Krishna, after that event, after Krishna had revealed him his powers to Lord Brahma, Lord Brahma said in his prayers, Tate Nukampam Shukshamikshamana. Unfortunately, I had some papers, but I left them on my desk. Go ahead. Do you have the translation? Yes, please read it. Because Lord Brahma, has a different mood. They're both Mahajans. Bhishma is a Mahajan, and Brahma is a Mahajan. There's 12 Mahajans that we follow in Vedic culture for knowing the truth. And they're both giving a different heart attitude toward what happens to them. Here we go. My dear Lord, one who earnestly awaits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds and offering you respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. So in this one, Lord Brahma is saying that all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's purport to this one, he points out that the material energy is so perfect, so synchronized, so harmonious, that every single living entity is being controlled by that material energy according to their specific nature. And therefore, everyone's given a particular body, a particular set of events, all the different karmic reactions to their past deeds. What happens is that the living entity has some sort of rebellious, improper attitude for one reason or another. That's never really understood why. Because of independence. Everybody's independent, ultimately. So some souls, their attitude is not quite right, and it requires correction to become servant of Krishna rather than that dominant idea of being the Lord. So this material world is created as a place of correction. And throughout it, just like in prison, a person is given a sentence according to their severity of their crime. So similarly, every single body in this world is like a little prison cell for the jiva. And it's all custom made for that person. So he's saying that with that attitude that I've done, I'm in a place of correction. I'm undergoing whatever suffering there is due to that. This is all under control. And I'm simply surrendered, awaiting your mercy. Then that's my rightful claim to liberation. Whereas Bhismadeva is instructing Yudhisthira very differently from the heart. If you consider the attitude, one is, I'm in a place of correction, I've been sinful, I'm suffering the reactions to my past sinful activities, and therefore I please give me your mercy. The other one is that I really haven't done anything wrong, I did my duty, I was properly situated, I followed the Brahmins, I followed the religious principles, I'm the son of Dharma, I have followed to the letter the righteous activities that were supposed to be performed by me, all my duties, and still I'm in this situation. So therefore, there's a more powerful plan going on here, and you're part of it, and now you have to continue doing your duty. So this is where Bhishmadeva is coming from in his presentation to Yudhisthira. Again, in my opinion, this is all due to inevitable time under whose control everyone and every planet is carried, just as the clouds are carried by the wind. Any questions or comments? Some appear?
Hare Krishna. I have to disagree a little bit.
I'm used to that.
I don't see a contradiction here.
I didn't say contradiction. I said difference of opinion, different of heart. Consider the heart how it acts when it's performing an action.
Right. So I think the heart has to be able to acknowledge both of these things, even in the same event, because the attitude of a devotee is always humble, even if he thinks this is the will of the Lord, this is inevitable time that is producing this situation. And my husband and I discussed this yesterday, that for 640 million people dying, and Yudhisthira taking that on his shoulders, that's actually a little bit clear that something so enormous didn't have to do with just one person. But when you bring it down to our little teeny-weeny level and our field of activities, things that happen to us, it's not as clear sometimes. You know what I'm saying? It's not as clear to surrender to the plan of the Lord. 640 million people died because of you. That's a little bit, you know, it's a little clear that is not because of one person. So But
how is that equated to these two different concepts?
And that was a, I guess that was an a side thing. But these, but a devotee's attitude is always that he's humble and simultaneously accepts the plan of the Lord and sees that this is inevitable time. So I think that both verses have to be
acknowledged. As I was contemplating why Bhishma Dev is speaking this way to Yudhisthira, the weight on Yudhisthira is overbearing. None of us will ever experience any kind of weight like that. That's what happens during the Lord's pastimes. He comes with his associates and they perform pastimes that magnify everything. So his situation is extremely magnified. And if the idea, the weight of this event is on him, that due to my sinful reaction, due to my desire to serve, to be the king, this is what's tormenting him. So that, the balm, the salve for that pain, for that overwhelming circumstance, is to take it away.
My question is, how is it possible? Is it just Krishna's plan?
Yes.
And his leela that you should feel this way, because it seems inconceivable that it's just like saying, well, World War II came about because of one person. We could say that it was just one person, but all the events and all the death and all the things that happened, it seems clearly more clear to be the plan of the Lord. How does a, I explain that. How does Yudhisthira think that it's all his fault? Such an enormous, like an earth-shattering, universal clash. How could that come about by anyone other than Lord Brahma or Lord Krishna?
Well, again, it's the relative perception. Again, he grew up in the palace. He was the son of Pandu. He was the oldest Kuru. He was meant to be emperor from the time he was born. He was educated and taught these things from his birth, that he would be the emperor of the world. And indeed, he did become emperor of the world, performed the Rajasuya sacrifice, was cheated in the dice game by Shakuni and Duryodhana, was forced into exile, spent that time, and now he's coming back and saying, as a Kshatriya, we just heard also part of that purport, was that Kshatriyas are stern people. They have a particular nature, and he was taught to do duty. So the question was, even Arjuna had the same dilemma. Here we are. We've come to this point. Take my chariot out to see the different people. And finally, when he looked, it hit him. You have got to be kidding me. We're going to kill all these people so that we can have a kingdom? It's not worth it. That's why I started off the class, if you remember, by saying the more embedded one's ideas are and heartfelt feelings, the harder it is for the heart to change. So even though Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, showed his universal form, and Arjuna agreed to fight, when you read the Mahabharata and you come up to that point where he's fighting with Bhishma Dev, it's like, why did Krishna get down off the chariot and pick up the wheel? Because Arjuna wasn't fighting fully with his heart. Because it hadn't been fully changed. He was doing his duty, he was doing it the best he could, but he couldn't kill his grandfather. He wasn't to that point yet. That took time. It took a series of events that led him to that determination. So, similarly, Yudhisthira is in this place now where all these people were killed. This really didn't have to be done. I should have just let Duryodhana continue all this death so that I can be king. No, I'm not going to do it. It's not worth it. So he needs to be convinced to take up that duty wholeheartedly. He's not there yet. Anything else on this topic? This, go ahead, Sukadeva.
In the purport to this verse, I remember Prabhupada talks about how sometimes, you know, because we often hear that it's the fan slowing down, so we get a, you know, just a little bit of the reaction we should have received. But he also says that sometimes that Krishna just makes an arrangement to break somebody's attachment to maybe, you know, a series of things. Like, I was thinking even with King Yudhisthira, that he was, you know, righteousness personified. And they say that Yudhisthira, his feet didn't touch the ground because he never lied. And they say that when he lied about Ashwatthama, his feet touched the ground. But, of course, the Vaishnava understanding is that Yudhisthira, the reason he touched the ground because he hesitated to lie when Krishna said, this is what you have to do, you know? So it's like Krishna, especially for devotees, you know, we don't always know, like someone could go through something terrible and think, okay, this is a reaction through simple activity, but what Prabhupada said in his purport is that sometimes Krishna just makes that arrangement to bring the devotee closer, just like Vritasura. You know, he could have just, he had the power to reverse the curse. But he didn't do that because Krishna's trying to bring him closer and he wanted to be closer. Anyway, just to...
And for us, I think, most of the time, almost all the time, it's impossible to trace back the cause of a particular circumstance. There was something else I wanted to... cover, and that is the difference between what goes on in this material world and what happens in the spiritual world and the atmosphere there. And this verse from Brahma Samhita has a nice purport which describes it. Advaita machuta manaramananta rupam adyam purana purusham navayovanam cha vedesu dulabam adulabam atma bhakto Govindamahari Purusham Tamaham Vajami. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is inaccessible to the Vedas, but obtainable by pure unalloyed devotion of the soul, who is without a second, who is not subject to decay, is without a beginning, whose form is endless, who is the beginning and the eternal Purusha. Yet he is a person possessing the beauty of a blooming youth. Can we go down to the purport? Keep going. Ah, okay, go back up to the top then, yeah. Down one. Though he indulges in exhibiting the pastimes of births, etc., still he is without a beginning. Though he disappears after the pastimes of his appearance, still he is eternal. Though without origin, yet he is with an origin in his pastimes of appearance. And although eternal in essence, he is still a person in the full bloom of youth. The sum and substance of it is that although he possesses diverse and apparently mutually contradictory qualities, still they are in universal harmonious concordance by dint of his unthinkable potency. This is what is meant by Chid Dharma, or the transcendental nature, as distinguished from material. His graceful threefold bending form with flute in hand possesses eternal blooming youth, and is above the unwholesomeness that is to be found in limited time and space. In the transcendental realm, there is no past and future, but only the unalloyed and immutable present time. In the transcendental sphere, there is no distinction between the object and its qualities, and no such identity as is found in the limited, mundane region. Just like Krishna's name and Krishna are non-different. In this world, it's a relative world. We never have an experience, never, ever, where the item and its name or its qualities are the same. They're different. The name of the person, like Prabhupada always gave that example of water. Just by chanting water, 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 one's thirst is not satisfied because the water and the name of the water are different. They're not the same. But in the spiritual world, the name of something and its qualities are the same. Hence, those qualities that seem to be apparently contradictory in light of the mundane conception, limited by time and space, exist in agreeable and dainty concordance in the spiritual realm. So what we experience here really isn't reality, according to what this is saying happens in the spiritual world. Now, the question arises, how can the jiva realize such unprecedented existence? The limited intellectual functions of the jiva is always contaminated by the influence of time and space, and is therefore not in a position to shake off this limitedness. If the potency of the cognitive function does not extend to the realization of the transcendental, what else can? In other words, if even your intelligence can't extend to the transcendental realm, then how can you possibly experience it, is the question being raised. In reply, Brahma says that the transcendental absolute is beyond the reach of the Vedas. The Vedas originate in sound, and sound originates in mundane ether. So the Vedas cannot present before us a direct view of the transcendental world, Goloka. It is only when the Vedas are imbued with the chit potency that they are enabled to deal with the transcendental. But Goloka reveals itself to every jiva soul when he is under the influence of the spiritual cognitive potency, joined to the essence of ecstatic potency. The ecstatic function of devotion is boundless, and it is surcharged with the unalloyed transcendental knowledge. That knowledge reveals Goloka Tattva, the principle of the highest transcendental, in unison with devotion, without asserting itself separately, but as a subsidiary to unalloyed devotion.
That's a very powerful.
That's a very powerful, yes, it is. What it's saying is that the transcendental energies of chit, which is knowledge, sat, chit, and ananda, which is the pleasure-giving potency, chit and ananda mix together and are bestowed upon the living entity by the grace of God due to the living entity's devotional service and surrendering to his representative. There's a formula for experiencing the transcendental, and it has nothing to do with the material as we've been describing and discussing. So I just thought it was an interesting feature to contrast with what we're talking about here, that this is all due to inevitable time. The whole place is under control of time and space. But in reality, what we're hankering for, what we're desiring, and what we're hoping to achieve is a place that has none of this. It's not a relative world, it's an eternal world where the transcendental activities are eternal without past, present, and future, birth, death, disease, and old age. And that contrast makes it much more, you can see the beauty and attractiveness compared to what we experience here.
Yeah, interesting. Same thing Prabhupada says in Chaitanya Charitamrita, I just put it up. 7.19. At least one of the most fascinating parts.
It what?
One of the most fascinating, same thing Prabhupada says in 7.19. It's like a very fascinating part.
Wow.
Yes.
Ramanya Prabhu.
Yes, Prabhu, thanks for the nice lecture. There was a lecture Srila Prabhupada was giving, and he's talking about the responsibilities of the kings, you know, the presidents of the country. And I think they're asking the question, because Prabhupada explains the king, you know, takes all the responsibilities of the citizens, the karma, you know. It's like the royal kings, the body kings, gives the example of Yudhishthira Maharaj, Parikshit Maharaj. The citizens were not suffering from heat or cold or happiness or distress. Everything was, you know, going under the royal king, the body king, very well in their kingdom. And that's why Yudhishthira Maharaj feels like that, that he's responsible because he's a king. He's responsible for all the suffering.
Also another consideration,
for the citizens.
I think so, in Mahabharata, go ahead.
They asked Prabhupada the question, what about the ISKCON, the temple presence and GVCs that take some of the 25% of the karma, you know, from the devotees? And Prabhupada said, why 25%? 100%. They take 100%.
Wow.
So that's related to the kings, you know, they're very responsible from the citizens. So that's the lecture, I think, is in Los Angeles, one in India.
Wow.
In Srila Prabhupada. The other thing, like how devotional service transcends all time and space, you know, the three kala. Gives the example of the Brahmana cooking sweet rice, you know, to offer to the deities in his meditation. So he put his fingers if it's cold, because the sweet rice, Prabhupada explains, it's supposed to be cold, you know, it's more pleasant, supposed to offer like that. No hot sweet rice, cold sweet rice. So he put his fingers and wake up from his meditation because he got burned. So it's a devotional service transcends time and place, you know.
Thank you. A good point that we didn't really cover, but what happens is that those potencies have to be bestowed upon the living entity. We can't ascend to that. No one's powerful enough to force that to happen. So therefore, the element of surrender is necessary.
I have a... I need a little more, maybe, input in that. In Madhurya Kadambini, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says, the self-pity...
Self-pity.
...is not humility. And humility is the backbone of bhakti. Mm. And then I remember that past times, I mean, we all know, that when the disciple told to Prabhupada that I am the most fallen, and Prabhupada said, you are not most of anything. So it was like a self-pity. But then Yudhishthira Maharaj's whole expressing his repentance or regretting, it's not a self-pity, or it can be self-pity with the devotion, because it's not self-pity is not a humility, first of all.
Yes.
And then I find Prabhupada, I get every day text from one group we have, Prabhupada's lecture, a particular.
Yeah.
And this lecture, in Bhagavad Gita, we see that if Arjuna would say, I can fight, then it will be false ego. And if you say, I don't want to fight, that is also false ego. But nimitta matra bhavasubhasachi, I will obey whatever you want me to do. That is the devotion. So whether I can...